Yeah, cool.
All right. This is an oral history recording on the 24th of May 2018 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist,
Tom Edlin,
Old Westminster history teacher,
and former pupil of
Richard Pyatt, English teacher.
Hi, Richard. As a bit of background, I wondered if you could tell us about your childhood, your parents, just a little bit to put your life into context.
Well, I was born in the city of Chester, and my parents and my wider family came from Merseyside and the Wirral area, but I grew up in rural Staffordshire and moved there at the age of six and came from reasonably humble origins. My father was a salesman and a director. All my family used to work for Lever Brothers, in fact. And I grew up in a little village which was a little bit like Cider with Rosie, except it then became a little bit more like Black Swan Green by David Mitchell. I went to the local grammar school in the local county town of Stafford.
And from there to university?
From there to Oxford University at the age of 18. And I lived in Oxford until 1986. So I was living in Oxford for 8 years, partly doing teaching work in the neighbouring town of High Wycombe, tutoring, working at the Ashmolean Museum, and being a bit of a layabout.
And were you always keen on the idea of being a teacher?
No, I was not keen on being a teacher. I didn't really know much about it. I'd had a very good relation with my teachers at school, and that may have given me some sense that it was a good thing to be. But I didn't really know what I was going to do when I left university, and I made the disastrous choice of going into a large company, Rankovis MacDougall, and that was just appalling, except I did get a big, red, shiny car for 6 months. But I continued to live in Oxford, and my main love was with literature and with books, and that allowed me to stay with friends who were still there and to indulge in my subject as much as possible. I got a place to be a postgraduate, but I didn't get any cash, so I had to think of other things. But I eventually did a PGCE at Oxford.
And then how did you come to Westminster?
I'd been working for 3 years at the John Hampden School in High Wycombe, and in my third year I started applying for posts. I wasn't hugely happy there, and I think probably that would have been the point when I actually left teaching altogether. But when I came to interview at Westminster School, it was just wonderful. And I was interviewed by Dave Edwards, and it was a very humorous and interesting interview. And I felt the moment I walked into this place that I was back home. It was probably the illusion that I was back in Oxford in London, but I felt completely at ease and therefore very much wanted the job. I'd also been offered a job at Queen's Harley Street at the same time, so that was a bit tricky, but I sorted that out by being deeply unprofessional.
In what way did you accept them?
Well,
both?
I accepted Queen's verbally, but not in writing. And I thought, well, had I accepted in writing, then I would have had to have gone to Queen's. But Westminster offered me something. Initially to teach history, a little history with English. I think they had 2.5 posts, and I was the runt of the litter. So I took on... I agreed I would have taught anything. I just wanted to be here. Not that I had any experience of public schools or anything like that. I just felt very much at home here. But I agreed initially to teach English and history. And the history somehow dropped away by the time I got to September. I was interviewed by John Ray, but by the time I arrived in September 1986, David Summerscale was in place.
You mentioned the change of headmaster and the fact that there were 2.5 posts and a lot of people had left or were leaving in 1986. Did you feel you were joining a school and a department in the midst of change?
Yes, because I came with Michael Mulligan and Charlotte Moore, and Gavin Griffiths had been the persecuted young Turk up to that point. And so there was a sense that the three of us were joining to renew the department and have some fun. And we were all very much in communication with each other, socialised with each other, and it was a rather heady atmosphere.
And there were, of course, some big beasts still in the English problem then, John Field, Jim Cooper.
There were. I mean, one can mythologise this a little bit too much, but there was a sense that Ray's legacy was still there, whatever that meant. I mean, it's probably the equivalent of, you know, Ayn Rand's kind of philosophy that these people do their own thing and don't take prisoners and so on. And I suppose they were intimidated, but I was excited as well by these figures, and they were clearly quite interested in us as a new members of the department. So John Field, for example, was seemed to be capable of anything, was putting on plays and was very dramatic at meetings and so on. And Jim Cogan was a more, you know, was a cultured but very sceptical man, and had natural authority to him. But I was tended to be a dog wagging his tail around these people. I wasn't in the least bit intimidated. And we were fairly combative in those days. We would argue about texts and books and ideas and take each other on. And that could get quite fiery. So it was it was still exciting to have these figures around. I didn't perhaps understand some of their hostility towards the new headmaster. That didn't make any sense to me, because David Summerscale was an English specialist himself and couldn't have been more courteous and more helpful and pleasant, and it was great to work under his tutelage, if that's the right word.
You obviously taught with all of these colleagues in this department and must have shared sixth form sets with many of them.
Yes.
Who did you most enjoy teaching with?
That's a harder thing to say in some ways, because even though you shared teaching groups, and this can be the case today, you didn't necessarily confer very much. And I have a very dim memory of who I shared sets with. I must have shared sets with them all. I knew them by their texts. I knew that, for example, that John Field liked teaching, I think, things like Lycidas and Milton and those sort of texts. And Dave Edwards also. Milton was quite big in the department, actually, and I wasn't really a Milton person. So who did I most enjoy with? Well, over the years, probably it was great fun to share a set with Gavin Griffiths, who quickly became a pal and a friend, although he could be very satirical about me and about everyone else, and is to this day. Probably, this is only guesswork now, if I shared a set with somebody like Charlotte or with Michael, who were contemporaries, then it was more of a kind of shared endeavour. I think we probably took the groups out together and this sort of thing, but my memory has faded a bit on that.
You talk about knowing them by the texts they taught. Well, which texts were you teaching?
Well, I was a magpie. I would try anything out. And, of course, I was still, as far as I was concerned, I came to Westminster to continue my own education, because it felt like that. It's often been described as a university for young people. Well, I was still young enough, I think, to qualify. I was only 26, 27. So everything I took up was extremely exciting. I probably returned to texts that I'd enjoyed at university at that point. And that often meant things, and that was very much taking poems into lessons rather than taking full text. So although things like Great Expectations were on the menu, and all sorts of Jane Austen was there, Northanger Abbey, and much later a lot of Persuasion and that sort of thing. My sort of feeling about what I was doing then was grabbing something, an extract or a poem, and taking that into the lesson, and often looking at rather obscure aspects of it. So if I took prose in, I might be looking at prose rhythm. So I was getting quite technical and enjoyed things like rhetorical terms and so on. One fifth form group, I even got to learn rhetorical terms and made that part of their fifth form exam, and that was fairly early on. So there was a sense in which I was a faux classicist of some sort.
Sounds like there was a lot of freedom to chart your own
course. There was complete freedom, and there was shared enthusiasm, so that if people were excited by something, they would put it your way and you might try that out. But I think there was quite a lot of kind of indulging taste that the pupils didn't necessarily pick up on. I can remember for a while doing the novels of Thomas Love Peacock. Well, good luck with that. You know, the only romantic, apart from Byron, who satirised the romantics. It was probably not necessarily working. I was too high on what I was teaching to sometimes notice that the pupils weren't necessarily in the same area, but it didn't seem to matter.
And do you feel now that there is any sense of a comparison that you're now one of those big beasts and the recent arrivals in the English department over the last couple of years?
No, because the dark side of the big beast, and I don't mean those two particular people, is that I don't think it's my place to have to be involved with, comment on, or have authority over younger members of the Con Room. And also, there are so many more members of the Con Room that I have difficulty remembering names sometimes. So there's a sense in which we're not... if you look at Con Room photographs from that period, they're about half the size of the later ones. So everybody knew everybody else. And I was just excited to meet everyone. For me, it was a sort of academic party. It wasn't until, I think, probably about 6 years in to Westminster that I realised that some social events at Westminster weren't necessarily meant to be enjoyable. So, you know, just because there was a glass of wine didn't mean to say you were going to have a great time, because I think I did have a great time. I was very, very into the place completely, and I couldn't get enough of sampling things and trying things out and being involved. Yeah, it was a good place to spend your youth.
One of the things you took on in those early years is you became editor of the Elizabethan.
I did.
And you were editor of the Elizabethan when I arrived as a pupil. I'm going to ask a loaded question here. Do you feel that you did something distinctive as editor of the Elizabethan? Because I sort of think I do, but...
Possibly. It was a bit like the black spot, and I think Dave Edwards gave me the black spot, and there I was with it. And the Elizabethan was smaller then, less of a record of the place, and it included Old Westminster News, which meant that your constituency was much bigger than the school, and that was rather formidable, especially if you put in obituaries of people who hadn't really passed away, which I did once, I think. That was an interesting phone call afterwards. And of course there was no easy way of researching what Old Westminster's were up to unless they communicated with the school. But I had a friend who led a rather obscure life because he had all sorts of mental problems, but was a pre-internet person in that he could move over newspapers and libraries and pick things up very easily. And it now looks, when you look back at my editions, that I must have had access to Google, but this was 10 years before, or more than Google. This friend of mine did all the research and found out extraordinary things about what Old Westminster's were up to. This wasn't done by the development office, it was done by my chum. And what books had been published by them, where they were now, what they were doing. And with that information, that made it distinct, I think. I was left very much to my own devices and developed a good relationship with Barrington Publications, who were themselves Old Westminster's down in Shepherd's Bush, and used to go down and cut and paste with them and sit in the office. And these are also chums of Gavin Griffiths, Old Westminster, so they were contemporaries of his. So that was very jolly. And it was also made into a kind of activity for the pupils here. So I do remember meeting people in a room in Liddell's who were essentially the kind of junior Elizabethan committee. But I think actually now I look at the magazine, I'm a little embarrassed by it, because although the covers and everything look nice, the content's pretty thin. And there are also things in there that just don't belong in there. So I shoved it, I think you got in touch with me, Elizabeth, about this. I shoved in the poem of a friend who'd come to talk here. And I also just put in an article about the 150th anniversary of the London Library. Nothing to do with Westminster School, whatever. But I thought it was a local event, and why not? Because my other attitude towards Westminster in those days is that it's all about London. So anything that happened in London was in some way a first or second cousin of this school. And I kept that mentality for a long time. So somehow this was all about, this was a super concentrated historical part of London. So I probably didn't think that was a silly thing to do, but we're not the London Library. And a lot of people said, what the hell's this doing in here? And I said, well, I went to it and had a nice time. So I thought I'd put it in.
There's also, I think, looking back at them, there's a lot in those editions which is very funny.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real humorous touch to it.
There was a slight... Well, this was the age of Blackadder when it first came out. So I did put in a sort of hustled history of things. Invented activities. It's tempting to do that now that I'm leaving, to pretend all sorts of things used to happen, you know, here that didn't. And I think that got in as well. I was a bit silly and a bit irresponsible with it, but nobody was supervising me, and one could safely assume that apart from Old Westminster's, nobody read it.
Huge circulation, we were always told. Tens of thousands.
Yes, yeah.
Of course, I think it was when you became head of English that you stopped editing Elizabethan, or there may have been a gap between the two.
I think there was a bit of a gap, yeah.
But you took over.
I think David Hargreaves may have taken it over after me. But it was only a short reign. It was only three or four editions. And Dave Edwards' Elizabethans are even rarer. I think there are only two editions of those.
But then you did become head of department in the mid-90s.
Yep.
You took over as head of department, and your predecessors as head of department were still there.
Yes.
And the headmaster was still there.
Yes.
Did you ever have departmental meetings?
Yes. Yes, we had them. By then, our sort of location was the third floor of Ashburnham House, so we had departmental meetings in places like room 30 at the top of the stairs. But we also had departmental meetings, I think, although I think I'm now remembering a previous era, in the library and down in the rooms at the back, Gibbon Room and that sort of thing. But I think that may be when Dave and Gavin were heads of department and sandwiches were provided and fruit. Some of the fruit flew across the room on one occasion when we got very heated. So, yes, I think my meeting... I ushered in a much more boring kind of bureaucratic age. I was quite scared at the post and felt I wasn't quite up to it. And so, like a lot of scared people, I used to churn out a lot of paper and documents as a sort of, you know, pufferfish puts out spikes, you know, to protect myself. I don't know. It wasn't a relaxed time, and I think also departments themselves were a little bit territorial. So I always felt I was defending the department against incoming stuff. Probably some of that was imaginary, but people were always looking at the numbers of people who did your subject and that sort of thing. They probably still are. Not so much at results, because people didn't need results as much then. And that was a difficulty in itself, because how did you... You were only as good as how... I mean, with GCSEs, that wasn't the case. But with A-level, you were only as good as how exciting the lessons were. Because they weren't going for that. They still wanted to get into Oxford and Cambridge. But that business of going for the best results wasn't quite there. So you were looking for... enthusiasts, and you were looking to generate a culture that was self-sustaining, if that's the right way of putting it. I hope I'm not misrepresenting the past, but it wasn't always that easy. And I think the older members of the department sort of put up with me, but they could bite if they needed to. John Field was not one of those. He'd gone in 1994. It wasn't that easy. It was politically, it was a political post to some extent, as well as an academic one.
And in total, you were actually head of English three times. Three different stints.
Yes.
Over an extended period, and a lot must have changed in terms of how that role had to evolve.
It was, yes. I think the second time was a sort of... one of those kind of dark age reigns. I was really caretaking for Tracy Morris when she was very ill, so that was one term. So essentially it's twice, but, you know, you might want to count the second time. I think by the time I came to look at the department again, I think they were looking for an outsider to come in, and I said, well, they asked me if I would caretake again. And I said, no, actually, I won't caretake. Either you give me the post or you don't. And Stephen Spur thought, I am delighted, and we went ahead. And by then, I was much older. I was about, oh, what was I? I was 48 or something. And I did feel very differently. It was a more cooperative venture. There were different members of the department then. So it had a different atmosphere to it.
Another thing that had changed was, of course, as head of English, you moved the department into Westerns.
Yes.
Which must have been quite exciting. What were the
best
the challenges
of my
that?
Life, you know, sort of thing. Well, we got a lovely floor on the second floor, and we all had pretty much our own classrooms. And from then on, we were able to not run the gauntlet of Ashburnham House as we went up to the rooms on the third floor through the maths department, which I didn't like doing because it always used to be those going to English who were latest for their lessons because we're that kind of soft liberal type of person. And so they were barked at and shouted at by maths teachers who used to ritually hang out on the staircase and shout at pupils. And of course we got the same treatment as we went up. And it just wasn't very comfortable. It was the whole sort of design of that building is that you lose your breath as you go up the staircase, but you go into smaller and smaller and smaller spaces as you're running out of breath. So I was always fractious and exhausted by the time I got up to the English rooms, especially if I was being hit, you know, going through all that shouting. So it was very heaven to go to the huge, cool, spacious rooms in this new building, essentially, old Edwardian offices, parliamentary offices that had been converted. And there was a tremendous novelty to that. And it felt as if the school was expanding and moving on in quite a nice way. I did love the way the old school was so concentrated around yard and that every room could be a classroom or a flat or a, you know, of interest. But by the time you got to the late 90s, that was all under strain, and it felt that we needed more space. But the Western building had been considered for two new houses, or for houses to move in there rather than classrooms. But luckily, Tristram Jones Parry went for classrooms in the end, so it was a benefit. And essentially, it's become the humanities block of the school, and that's fine.
Which is the classroom you'd say has been your favourite room to teach in?
Well, it's probably the one I'm in now, D20, because it just commands such a beautiful view of the Abbey. And the pupils genuinely appreciate being in there simply because they've got space and air and one of the best views of any classroom in the world. So D20 definitely. And I also like next door D21, which had similar features.
Not room 32,
no,
where you taught me.
No, not room 32. Although, when we let you out onto the balcony, that was fun. But I realise now that that probably was a risky venture.
They've screwed the windows down.
They've screwed the windows down. D25, which is the tiny little room at the back of the second floor of the Western Building, I also taught in as head of department next to my office. So there was a sense of office, little classroom. And that was quite fun. I packed an upper shell into that tiny room and managed to get them through their year in there. But it was a nice little sixth form room. I used to call it the London room because you could see straight into, you know, outside world, and the department, ironically, looked straight into the Department of Education.
Do you think that the move to Westerns had an effect on the sort of atmosphere among the pupils as well in terms of sort of...
Yes, I do. I think
they.
Yes, I think it meant. I mean, these things don't necessarily have an effect on each other. But the one of the biggest changes that's taken place in the school, as far as I'm concerned, is the number of societies, false or otherwise, and talks that the pupils run themselves. And the Western Building is very much part of that. And pupils didn't used to. I mean, they may have done other things. They may have read more. It was really only John Locke Society and a few a few department organised talks in the past. Now the proliferation of societies and talks, even outside guests coming to these talks, is extraordinary. And I think what the Western Building definitely plays its part in that, though not exclusively. I think talks go on all over the place. But yes, I think there's a sense of relief. I mean, it can be a bit lax. I mean, you know, pupils are notoriously a bit later for lessons and things when they come to the Western Building or leave from the Western Building. But it's a school, it's not quite a school within a school, but it has a faculty feeling to it, and it feels good when you enter it.
Do you think that Westminster classes have changed, or do they remain much the same?
You mean upper class aristocracy?
Well, the class system. Yeah. Okay, teaching groups, maybe.
Not hugely, no. I don't think so. I mean, the sixth form, you're still aiming ideally for about 12 to 13 people in each group, with mixed genders, as it were. There are certain kind of procedures that are different. There have been eras when pupils have been thought, you know, it's appropriate they stood up when a teacher walked into the room as a way of signalling the beginning of the classroom. But I can't speak for other teachers. And somewhere in the 90s, I stopped calling pupils by their second names. And
you called me by my surname. It was
you were Edlin then, but that probably didn't survive for more than a few years. And I don't know what that's a change in culture in the school or in the world. Mm. And I don't know whether I was the only teacher doing that.
One or two others. Charles Lowe did.
Yes. And that was probably my keeping a distance, my sense of, you know, that things could turn nasty unless there was some sort of formality. I did have discipline problems back then. I could have to think and have strategies and struggle a little bit, depending. There were golden years, but there were also, particularly when I was in my late 20s, early 30s, there were groups that really didn't want to know, and it was quite difficult sometimes. And I don't think there was anyone I could particularly go to for that, but people were sympathetic, and one way or the other I got through. But there were some tough groups, as well as wonderful groups. By the late 90s, I think most groups were sort of on board, and it was a slightly different atmosphere. But yes, it wasn't always easy.
Do you think things have changed a bit in the sixth form? We now have more girls joining the school, and the numbers have increased. And do you think they're more integrated in some ways?
Yes, I think they are. But how do I really know that? But they seem happy, and they also seem to quickly take over aspects. These societies I mentioned are a good example of that. And it's good to see as well the boys who've been here already forming friendships reasonably quickly with the girls, good strong friendships, less worry about amorous interaction than there used to be. I think before people used to think that was something we needed to keep an eye on. It seems to take care of itself now without becoming a problem. But again, I'm not a housemaster. What do I know?
I think you know quite a lot. Do you think this is something to do also with the pressures that the pupils are under? Because you mentioned in those days they didn't need the A-level grades. It didn't really matter what their results were if they got the university offer. And now, of course, they get these hugely inflated A-star offers.
Yes, and I think it probably goes beyond that into the wider world where they know that they need to, they don't quite know what's ahead of them. They know they're going to have to adapt to. I don't think that's an immediate fear or concern for them, because obviously they're thinking about their results in university. But I think they are thinking, well, I'm probably going to have to knuckle down earlier. I am aware of a more intimidating world out there. On the other hand, they're also in charge of it. They're well informed. The other big change is that at some point, you know, they started having mobile phones, and that is the big revolution that has changed. That they are wiser when it comes to the internet and the use of phones and technology. I'm aware, I'm about to say archaic terms now for sort of the, you know, by handheld devices and the World Wide Web, you know. They are as wise or wiser about that than their teachers, and they have their own way of surviving through that, which I suspect we still haven't really understood. They've never known any different now, of course.
Did you remember receiving your first ever school email?
No, I wish I'd kept that. I do remember that we had a school post before we had these things, where we'd send little letters and the post would be picked up from a pigeonhole in the common room. The pigeonholes were much bigger in those days because they might store things like bottles of wine and whiskey as well, you know, moose's heads. But there was a school post and you could say so-and-so college and it would be put on the notice board in college, and that was quite useful. It worked. I think there was a similar system at Oxford when I was there. What did you ask me about email? We had all sorts of ways communicating with each other without needing those things. Ho, ho, ho. You often just went to find someone. So I wouldn't dream of doing this now, but I often went into a boarding house and knocked on a school and said, here's your essay. I knocked on a door. And that seems extraordinary now, that you'd actually sort of go and look for a pupil, or they would come to the common room and knock on the door. Of course, that's disappeared now altogether. But first emails and so on. I can remember pioneering souls in the common room starting to use the computers when they arrived in the 90s. I think Danny Gill was trying to sort out station. He was head of station on a computer. And it was he would have been better off at that stage doing it with pen and paper, because it was such a labour for him to try and use the computer to help him sort out station. And he left in 94, so that's a very early use. Mm. But, I don't think people realise that emails and the internet, we had no safety nets. People didn't realise that if you put something out there, other people could retrieve it. We weren't actually warned about that. And to this day, there might be things floating around from that era that shouldn't be. But I know that David Summerscale, when he left in 1998, was given his email address by Nick Stevenson, who ran the computer department, and he simply put it in a drawer next to his desk and said, I will not be needing that. So he never emailed while here, and that's summer 98.
I'd never seen an email myself by summer 98.
Mm.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, if I gave you my English file from when I was a pupil, and you compared it with a pupil's file now, what would you find in that comparison?
It's handwritten. And that was very important, because you remembered and knew people through their handwriting style. It might have a few more form. I mean, Westminster's could always be a bit lax with their scripts, actually, but there probably were things like the date was on there, and a title might have been underlined. So they may have been following those kind of requirements, and we may have been requiring that of you. But how well enforced it was, I'm not quite sure. I don't know. I mean, the conscientious pupil is alive and well, and there were conscientious pupils back then. So, no huge change. People used to write in green ink for some reason, but I don't know. Not a huge difference, I don't think, apart from the fact that it's handwritten. There's probably a distinction then between sort of class work and what you hand in as prep, to a greater extent now. People don't seem to take notes anymore, but that may be just my deteriorating lessons. I'm not sure.
Do you think that you study with the same range of literature with upper school classes?
Yes, and even far more since we did pre-U. Mm. Where we're requiring them to read on their own. We allow them to sample. We teach books light as well as intensely. Mm. So we might have a text just for a couple of weeks so that they get the idea of it and the genre, and then go away and here are some more books by the same author or in the same period or in the same genre. So in fact, the number of books passing through English is enormous compared to what it was. And there is that sense as well that if a book isn't working, unless it's an exam text, you just walk, you try something else. You don't beat it to death. So it's still very good and it's very exciting. And I order the books for the department, so I've got a sense of the range of stuff coming in. But the pupils themselves are sourcing their own books.
Do you think there are fashions that have changed as well in terms of the type of books you're reading?
I don't know. There are fashions that probably we initiate, and then they can become settled in the department. So interwar literature is very popular with the pupils. So with Fitzgerald, and then more minor writers like Patrick Hamilton and so on. That period of modernism coming in and its relation to poems and texts is very fashionable, I think. But then there are big names that remain very fashionable, and particular texts that keep coming up. But we have our own enthusiasms, which we then, and we try to find acolytes. So Sharon Regatz tried to recruit William Faulknerists. I tried with Sir Walter Scott and got a handful of people. There's a text that simply won't go away from the department, which is Hemingway's Fiesta, and everybody seems to have a go at that. We're all signed up to that particular text, and yeah.
Yes, tell me more about the Walter Scott era, because I remember coming to teach one of your classes and you never invited me back, because I think I had a terrible effect on them, talking about 18th century politics and the Jacobites. But it seemed like a really exciting new departure, really, because I'd never read
it. I picked it up partly from, it was a pincer move, in fact, from Gavin Griffiths and Sharon Regatz, who'd been in the academic herself, and she had done papers on Sir Walter Scott, and I remember reading one of her papers on the women in Sir Walter Scott, and I just thought it was the missing bit of the Romantic period, because it's somebody who'd got down, written his poems, but then actually explored and scrutinised and examined Romanticism in terms of how it will play out with our understanding of history. So I thought it is a missing bit of an essential bit of the puzzle. And so it was a question of luring people in with smaller texts, such as Sir Walter Scott's The Highland Widow, which is a kind of little focused tragedy set on a fault line in history, just after Culloden, and it's got everything you want in it as a sort of trailer or as a taster for Sir Walter Scott. And how he treats history and how he treats the human emotions and loyalties that surround it, and the dilemma that everybody's in. So there was part of it that there's a little part of it that was me being silly and thinking, well, here's a rarity that no one else is doing. But it ran its course through the fifth form in terms of the Highland Widow, and I got at least 2 sixth forms to take up Waverley and Redgauntlet, which is a kind of even more fictional sequel to it. It got into the personal investigations in terms of being compared. So any Bildungsroman, we had quite a few people comparing Waverley with other novels about young men setting out in life, or young women for that matter. So I let it rest for a while now.
Do you think it tapped into questions about Britain, the matter of Britain? The Union.
Yes, it did, and it was really good during the during the vote for independence. And I've been thinking about it. I found an article in the Spectator which linked it up to Afghanistan and how Scott would have treated something like that. It's been around a bit more, and certainly relevant in terms of Brexit, I think, as well, worth thinking about. So, yes, I got some topicality out of it.
Of course, one of the great stories that we're always told is that in 1987, when a new day house was created, arguments about what to call it, and the choice of the name Hacklets may have been partly down to you.
It was down to me completely. I don't think anyone else suggested it. Now, I will take credit for it because I wrote a letter to the governors and they had put a letter on the notice board saying any suggestions, and the rumour was that it was going to be called Vincent's. I think that was pretty much the decision. But if any member, it was a very nice thing to do. And I looked at it and I thought, ooh, you know, I'm into rare figures who've... and I sent a letter, and I wish I had a copy of it, but I remember what my arguments were. Nobody will be able to spell it, therefore it will be distinct. He's a geographer, and geography ought to get more attention. And he's a writer, and there isn't an H in the school, and so on. I think I put my little, you know, my little points down. And Summerscale, who's... I mean, that was me being kind of a, you know, pushy fresher. But they decided on Hacklets, and Dave Cook was a little bit saying, oh, no, they've decided on Hacklets. Thanks a lot, Pyatt. Incidentally, you were addressed affectionately, in a slightly affectionate bullying way, by your surname in the common room. So if someone said, Richard, could I have a word? It was rather serious. If somebody said, Pyatt, as Jim Cogan would have done. And that applied to most male members of staff, and that might have not been very comfortable for the female members of staff. But you knew that a peer group was forming when we all called each other by our surnames. I mean, but if you were called by your first name, it meant that they were addressing you formally and seriously. So I was Pyatt until for a long time before I was Richard. And that was part of the thing. So, anyway... I claim Hacklets.
It's a rather nice touch as well, that because you were tutor in Liddell's for a long time, but then you moved to be a tutor in Hacklets, latterly.
So yes,
you got to be part of the house.
It was lovely, and I haven't moved around the houses very much at all compared to other members of staff who've been here for that length of time. I've only had Liddell's and Hacklets, and I do feel they're sister or brother houses, and they perform concerts together, and they're geographically next to each other, and I think they are kind of close to each other as houses.
Were you ever tempted by the idea of running a house yourself?
No, I'm not interested in parents at all. I'm interested in them insofar as they're relevant, and they're always I'm always very impressed at how understanding and pleasant they are when I meet them, but I wouldn't want to have to explain things to parents on a daily basis. Also, I wouldn't say that one of my strengths was pastoral work. I try to be conscientious and try to do what I can for pupils, but I'm much happier in a classroom with my subject. Much happier. I'm not so happy when I'm dealing with tutoring as such, though I will do it, and I've had, I hope, some success. But I find as well that I'm better with a group than I am in sort of one-to-one situations and so on. And that's just my being honest. But no, I haven't thought ever of being a housemaster at all. And so I take my hat off to you, because I think it's an extraordinary responsibility. And I'm hugely grateful to housemasters. I think one thing that works extremely well at this school is that you stop... You know, there's the atmosphere, and parents and difficult people burn up in it before they get anywhere near the teaching staff. And there was a period, particularly when the email first came along, when parents were getting through directly to teachers without their realising, you know, that they were under no obligation whatsoever to reply directly to them. And that stopped after a while. But housemasters do a tremendous job of protecting the school and the teaching staff, as far as I'm concerned, as well as all the other things you do.
Well, I mean, one could argue, of course, that one of your pastoral roles here has been in the common room.
Yes, I felt different.
That's very important as well. Yeah. Of course, you're common room president twice.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly when I came back to teach here, one of the most important people in the common room in terms of making me feel welcome here and part of a community here.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I did feel differently about that, and that was the only job where I was really working with adults and their concerns. There was a slight sense, perhaps, when I first stood as president, that I was standing up against authority in a sort of trade union-like way. And therefore I was a little bit more waspish and a little bit more militant about things, and had a sense that the Common Room was a political body akin to Parliament, and it needed to be defended against the House of Lords and the powers of the King. I really did feel like that. And at an earlier stage, I'd helped to draw up the Common Room and give it a constitution. And I felt very strongly that the Common Room ought to always be consulted and always have some sort of say within, you know, the realms of possibility about major decisions being made in the school. And certainly that's how I felt in my first presidency. In my second presidency, I wasn't quite so inflamed. It was more about managing people's needs and expectations, and dealing with, you know, there's a lot, you know, dealing with block lavatories and that sort of thing, and making sure that various parties took place. So a very different flavour, I think, to my more mature presidency, to the younger man who took over at the age of 40. It was a bit more political then. There were friends and enemies in an odd kind of way. There shouldn't have been, but it did feel more like that at that time.
Do you think it's a bit harder in the Common Room now because of the sheer size of the Common Room, apart from anything else?
It is, but then communication is vital to that. I mean, you can communicate by having social events. And Gilly, who's taken over, is doing very well at encouraging people and to go along to meetings and so on. There's still that sense of that there's the parliamentary committee, and members of the senior management team come along to give an account of why they're doing something. And I always felt, if you could have told us in advance, you wouldn't be in this situation of sitting there red-faced defending something, rather indignant that you were having to account for it. But I thought, well, they're there doing that and giving an account. But if only management never seems to quite learn that a little bit of consultation in advance can see these things off at the pass, and it's still the case that they don't realise that the Common Room is a great asset and can be used as a resource. They still haven't quite learned that, and they need to be reminded of that on frequent occasions.
The Common Room, of course, is a much more welcoming physical space in many ways now. Mm. And tell me about the part you played in the refurbishment.
Yes, well, it's changed. It's changed a bit, like the borders of Poland, you know, over the years. The major change took place later under, I think, Debbie Harris. But certainly there were fairly big changes under me, in that we widened access to the main drawing room. We put in new furniture, which is still there to this day, and a new bar and working area for the staff, looking after tea and coffee and so on. But the really big change came later, in fact, when it moved through to the other side of the entrance to the headmaster's office. And when the back of the Common Room, the old pigeonhole room, the old photocopier and the loos all disappeared and shifted into what had been Liddell's. So I was sort of a partial major change. But it was a difficult thing to handle. Because I had to deal with a lot of complaints and so on about that, and I myself was accused of not consulting the Common Room sufficiently about the changes we made. But it was interesting. It was a good experience for me, that, actually, even though there's not much to show for it now.
Are there any parts of this sort of smoke-filled back room that you miss now?
I miss the slightly heated and jocular debates that used to go on in the Common Room all the time, and that was a feature of the smoking room, and people were willing to challenge each other much more, usually affectionately, and that used to spill over into lots of pub visits and so on, but people could get quite heated, not just on school issues, but on principles and on even schools of criticism and so on in English. I mean, so there was a sense in which something might happen and a discussion might take place and other people might gather around it to see which way it would go. So we are no longer a debating common room. And that had its dark side in that I think probably some people may have felt that was a little bit too abrasive. But and I'm not sure it could be replicated now without treading on toes or being, here come the inverted commas, unprofessional.
And of course we've also got all these new positions and titles within the school.
Yeah, I've never...
It rather fragments that sense of we are members of the common room.
Well, I think there's a sense in which, you know, we've moved from being gifted amateurs through to being professionals, and that people are thinking about job titles and careers in a very serious way. And that's partly because we're aligning ourselves to the way the rest of the world works. And that we have to have something, you know, we're not just here out of community spirit because we got bored of, you know, private incomes or something. Most people are here now because they need a salary, which is quite a novelty. It wasn't always the case in the past. I certainly did. They didn't need the salary. The salary was an interesting extra.
In arrears, quarterly.
That's right. Most people now actually could do with their salaries. It makes a significant difference. The individuals who didn't need a salary just flashed up in my mind, but I won't name them. So there is a difference then, and I have to rein in my cynicism about that because I know how the world is now and how that's necessary, and that people can't just sort of knock about; they have to find some way of gaining recognition And also, you know, the training that goes with that. If you think of the training industry out there to kind of help people sort of define these posts or gain expertise in certain areas. I sometimes think, though, as a school, you need to remember that some of these things we don't need to do or be, and it would still be fine. But I don't feel people feel secure enough about that anymore. They're scared.
If you were to go back and give yourself a word of advice or encouragement in your 1986 self arriving at Westminster for the first time, what would you say? What would you have wanted to be told?
I wouldn't give myself too much advice because I think if I treated Westminster as a drug, then that launched me into it. I never applied for a post outside Westminster, and I never applied for a post within Westminster. So it was sufficient.
Just all happened.
It all happened. I fell back and it caught me. I would tell myself to listen a bit more. To pupils and to staff, I would and perhaps calm down a little bit, and I would also what else would I do? I would also actually tell myself not to kind of get too negative about people I worked with sometimes. I sometimes got myself into a kind of spiral of indignation and I could be very touchy and even sulky, and that seems ridiculous now. But then it was a very heated, very emotional, very combative atmosphere, and maybe that was good too. I don't know. I feel very different from the person who arrived here, so it's hard to advise him. I think he did well. He had fun and he taught lots of lessons. So leave him alone.
Excellent.
Is there anything that you want to say that we've not given you the opportunity to say?
Not really, no. I think in terms of having this interview, because I'm moving on, and I do feel that Westminster is something that one could do for a lifetime. But I do realise now that there are lots of things going on in the school that I don't really understand. And that's one of the indications why I need to move on. Obviously, I've made my own, you know, financial calculations as to whether it's possible to move on and things like that. But also, I don't... there's no danger in a place like this of becoming Mr. Chips, but I feel that the oldest, an even older version of myself who would be present here is not someone that I would want to be or the school should have to deal with. So it's good to be going, which seems an extraordinary thing to say.
But you'll still be close at hand? You're still staying in Westminster?
But for the time being, I have a flat next to the school, which is my own. It looks like a school flat. People come round and say, can't the school do anything better for you than this? And I say, but it's mine. So for the time being, I'll stay there. And I'm not going to say too much about what my intentions are, because I think it's dangerous to do that. But I'd like to do some writing, I'll put it like that. And after that, it sounds like the beauty contrast. You know, I'd like to bring hope and joy to the world. I'd like to travel. But I think it's teachers are obsessive planners, and we're always trying to justify what we're doing. So that's got to stop in some ways. But I don't know. I'm going to see what happens, I think.
Come back to lunch occasionally in College Hall?
No, my links with this place are powerful and can't really be broken. And I have friends here, and there are occasions which I can return to, and so on. So in that sense, things might just evolve rather than there being a major break.
Okay. Well, that's a good note to end on. Thank you very much.